Going online without ExpressVPN is like confessing your sins at church, but everyone can read your mind. You may not have anything to hide, but is it really everyone's business? This is why everyone needs a VPN, because all your traffic flows through their servers. Internet service providers, including mobile network providers, know every single website you visit. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your internet service provider can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN will hide your IP address, making it extremely difficult for third parties to track your online activity. All you have to do is fire up the app and click one button to get protected. I use ExpressVPN personally to protect my online activity from hackers, spammers, and the deep state. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/matter. That's expressvpn.com/matter. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/matter. There's a new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions called Morning Kick. It combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. All you do is mix with water, stir, and enjoy. It tastes like strawberry lemonade, not like ground-up spinach. Morning Kick is part of my daily routine. It's replaced orange juice in my life as the first place I go when I wake up. And since I've been drinking it, I've had better digestion and more energy. For me, that's important now that I have a newborn who, let's just say, doesn't always sleep like a baby. My health is important to me, just like it's important to you. I want to be the best version of myself spiritually, mentally, and physically. If you feel sluggish, it's worth giving Morning Kick a try. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/HARRIS today. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. It's a bit later than I wanted it to be. That wasn't an earthquake. That was me bumping into the camera stand there. it's a beautiful day. It's a hot day, though. Let me tell you what. I need to provide an explanation, especially for those of you who support the podcast. And I am thankful for all of you out there who pray and who also give as patrons. I could not do what I do, writing, speaking, this podcast even, without your support. So I just want to acknowledge that. And if you want to support the podcast, patreon.com/worldviewconversation. But I do owe you an explanation because I've been pretty missing in action the last week. And I've had several requests to talk about Megan's book again. Of course, I did interview her. That was over a month ago. Yeah, it was before my daughter was born. No, it was 2 days, 2 or 3 days after my daughter was born. So it was like late May, I think, when I did the interview, later part of May. And I released it, though, at the beginning of last week. And there was the backlash that I think everyone could have expected. And now there's a lot of people weighing in on it. And so I didn't feel the need to say a lot, but I couldn't say a lot. And that's really what I wanted to let you know about. I had a project I thought would take a day or maybe an afternoon. The roof of my garage was slumping a bit. And so I went out there and I started taking the roof apart a little bit just so I could see. And I thought it might be replacing a board because it was a low point a little bit, like the water was gathering there. And I thought there's some water damage. And then when I saw what it was and the carpenter ants, my heart just sank. And this is, I think, the third time. And I have a fixer upper. It was built in 1920. And it's an older house. What can I say? I grew up in a house that was from the 17, probably 60s or 70s. Yeah, it was that old. It predates the Constitution. It most likely predates the Declaration of Independence. And my dad was always working on stuff. And you get houses that are old like that in the Northeast. Well, mine's not that old, but it is 1920. So carpenter ants. So what I thought would take a day, maybe, has taken me about a week, and I just got done this afternoon around 3 o'clock. So I've been keeping one eye open a little bit on what's been going on. And I was aware of Gavin Ortland's stuff. I listened to actually both his podcasts about Megan's book last night so that I could understand what the critique was. I wasn't clear on what the critique was. That was part of the problem, is I only had the capacity in the last week to pretty much go on X, and I could put a tweet out there real quick and then get to work. And there's so many things I wanted to do, I couldn't. And so I didn't know exactly what the complaints were about. I saw that there was this big thing about Gavin Ortland, but I was like, well, what is it exactly? He says Megan Bastian misrepresented him, but how? And then I listened to his podcast and I thought, oh, that's why I didn't see anything that was really specific, because there really isn't anything that's that specific. Gavin Ortland is, well, we'll get into it. We'll get into it. I don't want to jump ahead of things here, but it's more optic style feelings. I think he thinks that he has legitimate point counterpoint, but when you look at what he says and what he tries to use to combat Megan's points about him, then you're just left thinking, okay, you don't like the fact, like, she's mean. That's basically it. Like, you feel like she was mean. She summarized your points. You don't like the summary. You don't like, you want to come off as more winsome, reasonable, third way. Let's just call it what it is. You want to come off as less political. And Megan pegged you for what you are. You're more political. You're more on the left on this issue. And that's the bottom line. And then some of the things that he was attributing, you know, that she said about him, she didn't really say about him. She was making general statements about a posture that exists in evangelicalism. So he took things way too personally, in my opinion. But James Royals asks, Ortland's video made me much more nervous about the book. He definitely brought up fair points and misrepresentation. I can understand why you might think that, to be quite honest, because when you're listening to it, and I listened to both of them in a row, his podcast, you think at the end, you're like, wow, that seemed like he seems reasonable. Like he see, like the way he talks, the way he comes across, the words he uses, the hushed tones, he doesn't seem unhinged. Even if he's boiling beneath the surface, which I think he probably is, he doesn't come across that way. Clearly it really bothers him, but he seems cool, calm, collected. And I think that in and of itself makes you second guess things. When someone comes across cool, calm, and collected, you just think, well, they seem pretty confident. I must be the one that's wrong then. Makes you second guess yourself. I can tell you this though, his podcasts don't age well. Like, there's something my wife and I talk about sometimes. You see a movie, you listen to a podcast, you read a book, or you have a conversation with a person, and we'll say that didn't age well. Meaning, in the moment you felt one way, or you had an impression. You were left with the idea that, or at least you were open to the idea that you might be wrong about something, or you're starting to be convinced in a certain direction. And then you, upon thinking about it, upon reflecting and digesting what was said, it didn't age well. And that's how I felt about Gavin Ortland's podcasts. It seems strong when you're listening to it, but it doesn't age well. And I would agree with Coach Hardenbrook. I watched both response videos and his clips from the original. I think and hope he misrepresents Basham and lumps himself in with the wolves and not the duped examples. I think that's, yeah, part of it. I do agree with that. I think he sees himself as like, he takes it very personally. Like, she's saying he's a shepherd for sale. And Megan does make it clear at multiple points in the book, as I remember, that there's a spectrum of motivations, and it's not like every single example is as egregious as every other example. Gavin Ortland, one of the things that surprised me, honestly, was Gavin Ortland is probably one of the less egregious examples in my mind from the book. In fact, I was having a hard time caring about what Gavin Ortland thought about what Megan Basham said. I'm not joking or lying. Obviously, I'm not lying, but I'm not joking about this. When I read in the book, and I read it pretty quick, because a lot of the information, I think I'm familiar with it, and I can do that with a book like this. So I went through it in one afternoon, a few hours. And when I got to that part and I saw Gavin Ortland's name, I remember thinking to myself, why even bring him up? Like, he doesn't seem that significant. Now, maybe he's more significant than I realize. He's a fellow at the Keller Center. He serves at Emmanuel Church in Nashville. And Russell Moore serves there. There's Sam Albury serves there. There's like a it's a kind of a nest of Big Eva people at that church. And of course, his dad is pretty influential. His brother, Dane Ortlund, wrote Gentle and Lowly. So, yeah, I mean, he's got some influence, but I'm like, I don't know if I've ever critiqued him on the podcast because he's just not generally someone who gets into a lot of political things. And he doesn't get into, I would say, a lot from what I know. And I don't listen to him all the time, but in fact, I've listened to him rarely. I pretty much only see him when there is a controversy. And there was one about theistic evolution, I believe. There was one about obviously now climate change, but I don't know. He just doesn't, because of the way he comes across, he's not a huge bomb thrower in my mind. And he's not someone that persuades a lot of people in my mind. So I was like, why is Megan talking about him? But now that she has talked about him, I've seen the reaction and I've seen how the wagons are circling around him. I'm thinking she knew something. I think I probably didn't, that there was definitely some influence there. And so I'm glad she did. Conceptual Clarity says, it seems like a Big Eva has decided that Ortlund is one of the least indefensible persons mentioned in the book. So therefore he needs to be the point man for the counterattack. That's probably, I mean, I'll just put it this way. If I was choosing from the book who I wanted to be the weak link, who I wanted to be the one to go after Megan to say, you misrepresented me, I would probably pick Gavin Ortlund, aside from any facts, just because of who he is. Just because he's, you know, sweet little old me. And it's not like Tim Keller or Russell Moore or, I don't know, any of the other big figures in there. He's just not someone that you're used to his name coming up. And so when you see his personality, he just seems more like, why would she go after him? And so that's why if I was making a decision of who would be the respond man, I would pick him. All right. Any other questions or comments? Get them in now, because I'm going to take you through a little bit of a slideshow here. Tom Carpenter says he didn't do it. This is all about Gavin Ortlund, which is next week. We're probably not going to be talking about him, but he didn't do a good job, honestly, of pointing it out because he tried to be too nice to her in that chapter one. She's bad argumentation, assumed knowledge, and outright lies. I'm assuming that's critical of Megan. I don't know. There's a fight going on in the chat right now. I can't quite keep up with what's directed at me and what's directed at someone else here. All right. So let's just get into it a bit. And we won't start with Gavin Ortlund. By the way, I do have the book pulled up on Kindle. If anyone has references or things they want me to look at or respond to or my opinion on, I can always check it out in the book in real time. And we'll do that. And I think it'll be profitable. So let's start. Where do we want to start? Let's start here. I think if I can pull it up on the screen. Let me, it formats it weird for some reason when I put it up on StreamYard, but legitimate issues. So let me just say there are two issues that I saw when looking through all the attacks on Megan's book. And the way the way this guy Ben Marsh frames it is like super over the top, dramatic in my opinion. But these are two issues that I thought, this is legitimate. Like, this is an actual issue. So let me start there. These are the strongest arguments against Megan's book, in my opinion. Wesley Hill, who's a side B gay Christianity kind of advocate. I don't know what term he would use. He may think that that's not a fair representation. I don't, because there's like three terms or four terms they use, but he's like on the same sex attraction is okay or not sinful train. And he said, taking a look at Megan Basham's book, which says, I graduated from a PCA seminary. I didn't. And there's only one. As a specialist, I judge generalist books by how they treat what I know something about, when I know something about it. If they don't get that right, I doubt the reliability of the rest. So I don't think that's completely unreasonable to say, like, oh, they're, like, if you get this wrong, what else may you have gotten wrong? I will generally give the benefit of the doubt, whether it's an article or even a book, because I am someone who has published a few books. And I also am pretty involved with TrueScript. And so I see the articles that come in. And even sometimes after editing, there will be things that slip through the cracks. And I'm not aware of anything like this in my books, but I do remember the last book that I published on social justice, Christianity and Social Justice, Religions and Conflict. I had to contact the publisher and who was a friend of mine. I decided to scale down because I was sick of, I didn't like dealing with, I shouldn't say sick. I wasn't sick, but I didn't care for dealing with a brick and mortar publisher as much. It just, I wanted to be able to talk to someone and, you know, get them with the first phone call and really get issues resolved. And I remember he got it resolved quick because it was just like a few grammatical things. And I'm like, how did this slip through the cracks? So I understand sometimes that kind of stuff happens. With a book like this, when you have lawyers going through it, when you have a major publishing company, this shouldn't happen, but somehow it did, because Wesley Hill did not go to a PCA seminary. Neither did Collins, the other guy described here as being part of Revoice, Nate Collins. He went to the SBC. He was very famously an adjunct at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Russell Fuller talked about how Al Mohler even knew about his dissertation, where he talks about the eunuchs in the Bible as being kind of like a category that we can place same-sex attracted Christians in, and it, you know, seemed fine with it. So yeah, this is, I'm going to just say this is legitimate, but like I wouldn't dismiss the whole thing because someone overlooked it wasn't a PCA seminary. I'm not sure what Megan was trying to say there or what the thought was. I'm sure there was something. They probably held an event at a PCA seminary, or there was support from a PCA seminary. There's probably a connection there. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but they didn't go there. And then you got this guy, Ben Marsh. I'm going to summarize this because he just, like, it's a wall of words that he takes a lot of time to say something very simple. And what he's trying to say is that World Relief received $215 million over a 10-year period from 2008 to 2018 from the government, I guess is what it is. So World Relief gets this money from the government for things like refugee resettlement over a 10-year period. Well, in the book, Megan apparently mentioned only 1 year. I think she mentions 2018 alone, and she attributes that figure to 2018 instead of 2008 to 2018. This is what I would consider to be a typo. This isn't even necessarily a content problem. This is just a number was left out. And because of that, he reads into this all kinds of motivation. She's trying to make it look worse than it is. Well, this is something that happens with articles and with publishing every now and then. That's why generally you have retractions. That's why you have second editions. I'm sure the Kindle edition is probably already either being corrected or corrected. So these are the kind of things that happen. And so I wouldn't fault the book or fault the content of the book for these two errors. I wouldn't say like, oh, you just dismiss the whole book because of these two things. These are very minor things. One's a typo, and one is a slight mistake that doesn't really take away from the content that she's trying to put out there. So those are legitimate issues. And I should probably just emphasize, because there might be some people that think like, I'm out there and all I'm trying to do is vindicate her and that's it. And it doesn't matter what people say, I'm not going to take it into account. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to vindicate her because I think she's onto something with this stuff I've been covering for years, but I can see legitimate issues when they arise. And I think Megan would be the first to admit that some of this stuff is the two things I at least just mentioned that, yeah, these were mistakes, typos, things like that. But to read all kinds of nefarious things into it, like, you know, give me a break. All right. So let's go to the next thing that I saw on Twitter or X. Phil Vischer. Hey, I'm Megan Basham's new book. I confess I have to read Phil Vischer in my head sometimes in a Bob the Tomato voice. I just don't know why. I just do, though. But he says, I'm in Megan Basham's new book, Shepherds for Sale. I made the introduction. My sin, the reason I'm a leader, pimping their pulpit, which isn't something I don't even think she said that in the book. I think that was a tweet. But is her claim that I started arguing for evangelicals to be more nuanced about abortion. I was curious what talk I gave that she was referring to. And then he says that basically there's no source for this. She's just making stuff up about me. That's the bottom line. And so then Megan posts a screenshot from Phil Vischer. And it's Phil Vischer saying, on next week's show, this is in 2022, we talk about our conservative Christians' inability to bring nuance to conversations about abortion as opposed to other life and death issues where we find nuance aplenty. It's a real interesting conversation. It's a really interesting conversation. And so he, like, Megan immediately says, here's a source right here. This is where you said it. And then, you know, I remember this interaction. I do remember this from 2022. I seem to remember too, and I didn't go back and look for it, but I seem to remember, I think it was Woke Preacher Clips, cut a snippet where he makes this same point on camera where he talks about evangelicals. I don't know if he uses the word nuance, but their lack of nuance on abortion and that kind of thing. But anyway, William Wolfe found him saying in response to William Wolfe, Phil, do you support legal abortion in instances of pregnancy resulting from rape? Phil Vischer says, I don't have a specific position, but probably if it's early in the pregnancy. So there you go. Phil Vischer does have, I wouldn't call it nuanced, I would call it incorrect, but he has a somewhat, soft is even too nice. He's got a liberal bent to his abortion position. Let's just call it what it is. He's got a liberal bent and he wants exceptions. And I believe the exceptions were, you know, rape and incest, but he hasn't thought through it very deeply, apparently, because he can't give a straight answer on that, or he couldn't at the time. And there he is saying that evangelical conservative ones specifically have a problem nuancing this issue. And that's really all that Megan said about him. So I would just say that's, there's nothing here. This is a big nothing burger. And then you have Samuel James. I don't even know who this is, to be honest. I probably interacted with him on X at some point, but because I recognize the name, but I'm not sure what the significance is, except that he was one of the first to get, I guess, a critical review out there. And, you know, I went through it and so many of the claims are just so minor or they're just so slanted. I didn't think it was worth it to really go over every single one of them and we'd be here forever with all the information I'm trying to give. So I just went through two of them that I thought were representative and maybe even a little stronger. He says there are multiple claims in this chapter of the book. One of which is true, one of which is false, one of which is a sheer speculation. So I want to just talk about these first. So he says the first claim is true that George Soros Foundation, this is about the immigration chapter. George Soros' foundation does donate to the National Immigration Foundation, with which the Evangelical Immigration Table and the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission both freely acknowledge. Now, I don't think they've always, have they always freely acknowledged this? I know Baptist Press denied it at one time that there was any Soros connection there, but all right, like, fine. So that's true. He goes, the second claim is that rank and file Southern Baptists are being misrepresented by their leaders on this issue. This is not true. And what's his evidence? The resolution that Basham mentions was passed overwhelmingly from the floor of the convention. So she mentions a resolution at the Southern Baptist Convention on immigration that pushes the needle left. I've made this point many times. You can look at immigration resolutions that have been made over the last 20 years in the Southern Baptist Convention, and they go from a very law and order, let's enforce the laws that are there, to we need an option that's not apparently on the table right now. We need to, as Christians, come up with some kind of a compassionate option to deal with the people who are here. And it really does start shifting left. I did a whole podcast on this, I don't know, a year ago. So she's talking about that. And his evidence that she's wrong is to say that rank and file Southern Baptists are, they are out of step with the leaders, is that, look, they voted for it from the convention floor. And stuff like this is just, it's ignorant. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, the Southern Baptist Convention, when they meet in their convention meetings, it's not like you have everyone there's rank and file Southern Baptist. Rank and file Southern Baptist overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump, well more than 80%. You have at the convention, and I'll just say this about that, I guess. A vote for Donald Trump, especially in 2016 and then in 2020 and then again this year, the issue he primarily runs on is the immigration issue. So the people who vote for him, it'd be very odd if the rank and file Southern Baptists out there who vote for Trump, they disagree on his immigration policies or something. No, they want his immigration policies. They're concerned about those issues. Anyone who goes to a Southern Baptist convention meeting knows that the people in that room don't all represent rank and file Southern Baptists. There is a very, very large, and I would say they control the convention contingent there, that is part of the industry, for lack of a better word, it's NAM people. It's people that are connected to the institutions and the entities in the Southern Baptist Convention. You definitely have your pastors coming out, but there's a lot of mega church pastors also that bring their staff. They have the budget to do that. It's not a representative picture of the Southern Baptist Convention. And I just thought everyone knew that, but he also says, however, this is again a part of the article critiquing Megan Basham. One figure that does not receive any criticism whatsoever in Shepherds for Sale is Russell Moore's predecessor at the RLC, Richard Land. It was Land who pioneered the SBC efforts through the ERLC to advocate for these issues. And then Megan Basham posts on X the part of her book where she says, I can barely read it. This was not a small matter because largely under the direction of first Richard Land and then Russell Moore, the ERLC's ethics, their commission had become basically compromising on immigration, joining the evangelical immigration table and pushing the message of the evangelical immigration table. She does blame Richard Land. It's just that Richard Land wasn't there for a lot of this. Russell Moore was there for a lot of this, and he pushed the needle very far left when he was in it. So, like, it's not like Richard Land's not mentioned, but like, these are the kind of takedowns you get that are supposed to be so overwhelmingly accurate and show the complete distortions that Megan Basham's putting out there. And I am very, very unimpressed with this kind of thing. Gavin Ortland. So let's get into Gavin Ortland, shall we? A little bit. I know everyone sitting in the chat seems to want to talk about Gavin Ortland. All right, I'm not going to take any questions. It looks like there's a healthy discussion going on. So if you're on the fence and wanting to join the chat, I'm going to look for those question marks. That's what I look for if I'm going to put your comment out there. So let me know. All right, let's talk about this. Gavin Ortland. So compliments of enemies within the church, Kyle Witt, he sent this to me and I thought, good work, Kyle. This is from Gavin Ortland's Discord channel. Discord is just another social media website for those who don't know. And I'm not going to read you this whole thing, but from 2022, Gavin Ortland says that I personally don't think Megan Basham is a good, argues in good faith, basically. I think she is a relentless troll. That's what he calls her, a relentless troll. This is in 2022. I didn't know this, but Gavin Ortland apparently has had a problem with Megan Basham for some time. Here's some more from Gavin Ortland. If I can, I know that's so small. Most of you probably can't read it. He's saying that people definitely have their wheelhouse. Someone says this to him. All right. So they say Megan Basham is fine in the political area, but she doesn't understand theology, basically. And so Gavin Ortland responds and says, one thing just to clarify, I couldn't agree Megan is fine in the political arena. It's usually her comments in that arena that concern me the most, even though I'm more conservative than not. So he doesn't seem to like Megan. There's another area here where someone says, I can only imagine the field day Megan Basham will have with a interview that Gavin Ortland does with Bill, is it Bill Watkins or Chris Watkins? I'm trying to remember. Christopher Watkins, yes. Biblical Critical Theory. I started reading that book, by the way. I was going to do a review on it. Maybe I still will, but I was like, this is not what I was anticipating. I think a lot of people thought that it was, I don't want to get sidetracked on a biblical critical theory. I'll just say this. I think a lot of people thought that this was critical theory and trying to pigeonhole it into like a biblical framework. It's not really that. It's trying to take the Bible and use it to critique the culture, supposedly. I think it's lacking in many ways. It makes actually some decent points, but it's overall, it's just redundant in my mind. Like, it's just a lot of information that, I don't know, it seemed obvious to me, or you could pull it from a lot of other sources. And I don't know, I didn't think it was a very helpful book. But anyway, that being said, they're both Keller Center folks. Maybe that's why someone's saying this. I don't know. But the response of Gavin Ortland is, oh, wow, didn't even consider that. He's using the term critical theories. Then he says, yeah, Okay, because he says, I would have thought that using the Bible to develop a critical theory of culture would be something even someone like Megan Basham could agree to. So there you go. Gavin Ortlund, not a big fan of Megan. He doesn't like Megan Basham. So whatever you heard in that video of Gavin Ortlund coming across is like, he says things like, yeah, I have no ill will for her. I prayed for her family. And I just, he wants to get to the point at some point, I guess, of being able to have a conversation. It's just like, that's the impression you get from his video. His first one, especially, like, he just wants to have a conversation. That's what he's saying about Megan on social media 2 years ago. So I'm not getting the third way, nuanced, winsome. I'm just kind of here for the conversation and the journey of it all. That's not really what Gavin Ortlund's been doing. So keep that in mind if you haven't listened to his stuff yet, and if you plan to, just keep that in mind. All right. So let's keep going here. Zach Terry points this out. Okay. So actually, first, let me point this out. Truth Unites, which is Gavin Ortlund's page on YouTube, starts in his organization's name, I guess. He starts going on YouTube comments. And like, this is one on the Alyssa Childers, I think it's Childers show, where he says, Alyssa Childers. The misrepresentations in Meg's book are clear and in some cases simply matter of fact and biography. That has nothing to do with Big Eva trying to discredit her. It has to do with me, an individual person responding to specific claims made about that are factually and verifiably incorrect. I gave page numbers in my video so that you can confirm for yourself. So he's saying, I got the receipts. She's coming after me. And I guess he was doing this. I don't know to what extent. I didn't check my YouTube channel. I don't know if he probably wouldn't bother on mine. Probably knows the answer. But this guy named Zach Terry goes, I've heard from guys who haven't reached out since seminary to get me to pull my interview. So he interviewed Megan Basham. And there's people are freaking out about this. They really are freaking out. Let me take a question and then we'll get back to the podcast here. John, do you think Basham should have or should in the future do some work on her first chapter? Work as in what? Like issuing some edits or like, I'm not sure what work you would mean by that. I don't know. I think one of the things, someone posted this on X earlier today. That was a great point. One of the things that's happening here is you have people who would not be aware of Megan's book, but they're now aware because there's people that they follow in the Christian world who are responding to what they see as attacks. And it's causing them to go down the rabbit hole. And even her first chapter, I guess the assumption there is that's a weaker chapter. I don't know. But even in that chapter, I think it's helpful because I think she would say this too. Anyone who wants to check her sources, do it. Go ahead, look at the speeches that she quotes, look at the tweets she quotes, whatever she's quoting, the books, go check them out. And you're going to find out things about the evangelical world you may never have known. You know, you might not be someone who's on Twitter or X and in the political realm. You might not be listening to my podcast or Eddie Robles' podcast. You don't read Protestia, right? Like you're just totally off the grid on these things. But now all of a sudden, there's a problem that you're seeing for the first time. And so for that reason, I think this book, including the first chapter, is super important. And is any book a perfect book? I'm pretty hard on books, so I would say no. And Megan's isn't a perfect book, but it is a very helpful book. So let's keep going with Gavin here. So Gavin Ortlund. Maybe my slides are out of order. Let me just check here because I thought I had... Is that all I have on Gavin Ortlund? All right. Well, let me play the clip from Gavin Ortlund then, because that's the last slide I have on Gavin Ortlund. So I have a clip that I want to play for you. And this is the podcast that Megan Basham is talking about in her book, where Gavin Ortlund, it's one of the sources where Gavin Ortlund talks about climate change. I want you to listen to his words himself and see what you think. And then you can compare what Megan said to what Gavin Ortlund said. So here we go.
I have been misrepresented before.
My YouTube channel is mainly focused on apologetics and theology and things like that. So I want to talk about climate change. And I have five things to say from a Christian perspective, particularly. I care about it so much, I think we can't not talk about it. It's just too important. The climate affects everything. Now, it is true, as people often point out, that climate change is extremely common and kind of severe throughout Earth's history. So you can go back to times, I think it was like around 50 million years ago, there's basically no ice anywhere. And you've got, you know, islands near the North Pole with huge trees, and the annual mean temperature at the North Pole 50 million years ago is 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And then you can find other times where there's ice ages and it's really, really cold. So the temperature does vary naturally. It's just good to observe, first of all, that there is pretty much a scientific consensus, or a very close to a scientific consensus, on human-caused climate change as a very real problem. If you're going to go against a near consensus in the scientific community, study it and make sure that that's a wise thing to do, because I see a lot of people reacting instinctively rather than really hitting the books. And I don't think that that's a responsible posture for Christians to take. Basic idea of climate change is not only extremely well supported in the scientific community, it's also very intuitive and commonsensical and basic. You've got a lot more people alive today. Going back to the principles of just basic wisdom and planning, we have to think about, how do we do that? How do we manage that? You know, where might that put a strain on resources and so forth? And here's the main problem. It's not the number of human beings, though that can contribute to what is the main problem, and that's the technological advances since the Industrial Revolution have dramatically altered how we relate to the environment. And to put it really simply, we have forms of technology that consume huge amounts of what are called fossil fuels. So,
let me just say something. There are captions on this that I did not put there. I'm actually not sure who originally made this video. So this was going around X. So my apologies, because I usually want to attribute. Maybe if someone knows who made it, they could put it in the comments. But this is, I just found this to be a helpful arrangement of clips of Gavin Ortland talking about climate change from one of his podcasts. So instead of watching all 50 minutes on this podcast, which would make this podcast very long, let's just watch these few clips. But those captions are not from me.
Sources of energy like coal, natural gas, petroleum, things like this. And we use these to power our cars and our homes and our airplanes and so forth. And in so doing, they emit greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide. Huge increases in emissions of greenhouse gases. The reason that's a problem is because, first of all, greenhouse gases stay in the atmosphere forever, practically. But basically, they trap more heat energy from the sun. So it's like putting more blankets on at night. You can observe the greenhouse effect at the local level very easy. It's not in dispute as such. From 2007 on, every other scientific body of national or international standing agrees that human-caused global warming is a serious problem. So the level of conspiracy and hoax it would be if somehow all of these different... People think that scientists are all... together. People have this distrust of science. Science is an inherently conservative process. And these people are not all in cahoots with each other, you know? If somebody could disprove this, there'd be much incentive to do that. And yet you have so much agreement in the scientific community. And some of the things are obvious, like you think of sea level rise. Other things you may not think of right away, but even just...
I'm sorry. There'd just be so much incentive, so much. Because science is conservative. I don't even like what I don't know what his degrees are in. He sounds like a seminary guy to me. Like, and I've been to seminary, I've been to grad school. But I don't know. I went to secular undergrad, and I had to do physics and biology and that kind of stuff. And I'm just thinking, like, no, they wouldn't. My teacher would have lost her job if she had tried to buck the scientific quote unquote consensus on this. You remember years ago, there was that scandal in Great Britain. I think it was at Oxford, where they found out there was these private emails. It might've been part of the WikiLeaks, where they showed these scientists willing to fudge data because there's a huge incentive not to report things that would reinforce, if you want to call it conservative, a conservative perspective on this. Because, well, it's obvious, because the government benefits from, they gain more control, and there's more more ability to use your resources and regulate what you do with your life if there's this huge problem that only they can address. I don't know why I have to say this, but I probably shouldn't. Let's just keep going. I'm sorry.
Sea level rise is a big deal. 11 out of the 15 largest cities in the world are on coastal estuaries. So you can see this happening already. It's not like a distant hypothesis. You see it happening in places like New Orleans or Venice. You also have more intense hurricanes because they are fueled by the warmer waters in the summer. You have more wildfires, which I live in Southern California. I can tell you how devastating those are, partly because of drought, but also because of drier air. The oceans become more acidic as ice melts and other forms of pollution. You know, richer countries like the United States, which we consume so much per capita, it's embarrassing how much we consume. We won't face the direct effects as much, probably, as other places in the world. If you are pro-life, you should care about climate change. Because when there is a drought or a famine in a poor country, people die. The particular beliefs of Christianity, the particular worldview that is inculcated by the Christian gospel, is one that should naturally incline us to care about issues of stewardship and sustainability and responsible usage of resources and things like that. I'm just deeply concerned that there is an anti-science mentality that evangelicals often have. And then there's just basic principles that all Christians believe in that play into an issue like climate change. Wisdom in planning for the future, opposition to greed, contentment and valuing simplicity and modesty of lifestyle. You think of Proverbs 38, which says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Second of all, the basic principle of love your neighbor. Issues of environmental stewardship and particularly climate change have been associated with political liberalism, and evangelicals have tended to be politically conservative. And I think that is the biggest single factor for why more Christians aren't more active in kind of leading the charge on something like climate change. And I'm not trying to scare people with this. That's not the motive, but it's just trying to be accurate. And we need to understand what a big deal this is. I just think that a big part of how we're going to make progress is spreading more knowledge and making this more of just something that's out on the table that we're thinking about, that we're aware of. Now, I'm aware that that's not all we need to do, of course. In fact, that's one tiny thing compared to everything we need to do. If people would just, you know, do some research about it and then have an opinion, that alone is, because all change starts in the hearts and minds of people. It just seems like it's one of those issues that should be way high on the level of urgency.
Now, I have been misrepresented.
Okay. All right. Wow. We got some comments coming in. My goodness. Wow, John. I cannot believe this is your take on the Ortlund situation. I expected you to be the voice of reason. She misrepresented his statements! ! This is called lying. Show me where. I listened to both his podcasts. I looked at everything that I saw online that I could find where he and Megan go back and forth and all of this. I couldn't sink my teeth into any of it. It's mostly him being upset at the way she summarizes things. It's him taking things that weren't even directly attributed to him and owning them as if they were attributed to him. And then you just hear what he said. I mean, there's a scientific consensus. And this is, he does pigeonhole this into being a pro-life issue of some kind, or at least it's on that level. If you're concerned about the pro-life issue, you should be concerned about this. And it's part of your Christian responsibility somehow to be concerned about this kind of thing. And he really wants to harp on that last section there. That's one of the things he played in his videos, was the clip at the end there where he says, basically, you do the research. And he wants that to seem like he's so open-ended. He's so open to both sides. Just do the research and figure this out. But he clearly is advocating for a side. I mean, he even goes to the point of thinking these storms are the result of global warming because they're stronger. And we don't have proof of any of this. Go watch the podcast I did with Brian Sussman, who was a meteorologist for years. I did that a few months ago. I also did one a few months ago with Colin Reeves, where we debunk Jonathan Moo's presentation at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, which Megan Basham also goes through a whole bunch. This stuff is not proven. This stuff is not even science, some of the things he talks about here. He is clearly pushing the needle left, and he's trying to make it part of a Christian's responsibility. It's part of their being a Christian to be involved in this kind of stuff. And from a leftward angle, it's obvious if you just go watch the whole thing, watch the 50-minute podcast, if you have the time for it, of Gavin Ortland talking about this. So again, I'm not like getting animated because of his position. Like, I could care less, to be honest with you. I'm more just like, why is this tirade against Megan that she's lying somehow? Why is that even happening? Like, let's just see the evidence. So I'm still open. If there's something I haven't seen, go ahead and put it out there. So let's see. Bad take, John. Backing the wrong horse. Okay. I'm on the side of truth here, man. It's not like a strategic, political move to benefit myself or something like that. Let's see. Did we already read this? It just sickens me that conservatives are defending her behavior and tactics. I'm not going to strap myself to everything Megan Basham's ever said or done, but I think when it's a cheap shot against her, then yeah. Because frankly, if you listen to what Gavin Ortland's saying and some of the other critics, and I'll get into some of that in a minute, because Neil Shenby put some thread out today, it would basically be the end of science, not science, sorry. I'm still on Gavin Ortland's video in my mind. It would be the end of research. It'd be the end of the scholarly process. If you can't summarize what someone said and try to interact with it. If you can't, you have to quote everything someone said in a 15-minute video or you're not representing them. You can't actually have a discussion if that's true. You have to be able to reason. That's what scholarship is about. You take representative quotes. You supply the context in summaries. You have to. There's no other way to write a paper. I'm just telling you. There is no other way to do it. So that's what Megan did. And maybe what we'll do is we'll just read the part, because it's actually pretty short, about Gavin Ortland, just so people can hear what Megan said. You just heard some stuff Gavin said. You know, let's hear what Megan said. And then I'm gaslighting you. Okay. All right. All right, Colonel JD. Let's read what Megan said. I do think she accurately summarized Ortland. Let's read it. Let's just do it. Maybe this will be a longer podcast than I anticipated, but I think that's fine. Let me see if I can get it on the screen here. Yeah, there we go. There's the book. There's the section on climate change. Someone did say, like, do you think she should she should have started with this chapter? And frankly, I probably wouldn't have. I'm sure there was a reason for it. I don't think it was the strongest chapter in every way, just because multiple reasons. A lot of the stuff is especially her talking about stuff from like 2009, not saying not to talk about it. It's just the immigration issue is more hot, current. There's a lot more, I think, traceable money and that kind of thing. But anyway, let's just find Ortland. Let's find his name in this. Okay. So there's page 24. There's a few pages that he's mentioned. Let's start here. California pastor Gavin Ortland. So story time with John. California pastor Gavin Ortland may not have reached the name recognition of Rick Warren or the institutional heights of Richard Cizik. But as New America has illustrated, that model didn't work for the EEN. I think that's the Evangelical Environmental Network. And Ortland, whose laid-back Ventura County style and hushed manner of speaking give him something of a preppy guru vibe. So people are making fun of this online. By the way, this is a style thing. I don't write this way. I write a lot more academically, I think, or I tend to. I'm not saying all my works are academic. They're popular-level works. But, like, this is an aside that a journalist, someone who's trained in journalism, would put in there. It's a summary statement. That's her impression. And I have to say, when I was listening to him, I was like, yeah, that makes total sense. Anyway, he would certainly live up to Lowe's idea of a grassroots campaign catalyst among young evangelicals. Ortland's not only a popular author, but also a fellow with the Gospel Coalition's Keller Center. His YouTube channel has developed a wide following. In 2022, Ortland released a video, the one we played clips from, that did not delve into, let's see, okay, apologetics and theology. Okay, that's what he talks about. But he did this climate change episode in 2022, which we just played clips from. And he talked, and she quotes him, or at least takes quotes and summarizes and that kind of thing. Evangelicals have been very skeptical or apathetic about the issue because they've been politicized by the right. He begins in a characteristically soft tones by asking his audience to consider orienting their posture to the subject in such a way that is not to be closed off. He then shares that he's deeply burdened that too many Christians have dismissed the idea that human-caused climate change poses a significant risk to humanity without having studied it, not based on the evidence, but based on sociopolitical associations. I think the main thing is just in the United States in recent decades, though not back in earlier times, issues of environmental stewardship and particularly climate change have been associated with political liberalism. That's a quote from him. He goes on. The quote continues, and evangelicals have tended to be politically conservative, and I think that is the biggest single factor for why more Christians aren't more active in leading the charge on something like climate change. From there, Ortland launches into a layman's recitation of the most common tenets of the climate change movement, namely that it is settled science because, quote, every other scientific body of national or international standing agrees that human-caused global warming is a serious problem, unquote. Is there anything so far that jumps out at you like she's misrepresenting him? I don't see it. His descriptions of the wages of climate change are as hyperbolic as anything coming from United Nations star Greta Thunberg, beginning with the claim that it is a very big deal. The consequent, and I think this is something that bothered some people, like he's comparing her to Greta Thunberg. Okay, but she's just saying his opinion is similar to Greta Thunberg's. It is. It's not exact in every way. He doesn't have the same quote-unquote worldview, if you want to get into worldview language, but yeah, he has a similar position on it. Like that shouldn't really make people angry. The consequences are very severe, is a quote. A lot of the things that you might not think of is just the increase in extreme local weather events. We already watched this video, but I'm reading it again. And people live closer together, causes greater spread of infectious diseases. Let's say you don't have any snow cap or you don't have enough water, all your crops die because when there's a drought or a famine in a poor country, people die. When there's flooding and wildfires, people die. And the scary thing is, you know, seeing the ripple effects of famine and things like that causes political problems, and that can lead to war. So these are all the negative effects of quote unquote climate change, which happen in these third world, less industrialized areas, apparently. Ortland finishes this portion of the video by saying he is not trying to be apocalyptic or a doomsday person, but it's hard to imagine what he might have said differently if he were. That's an opinion statement, by the way, that Megan's making there. She's saying it seems to fit with doomsday language, even though he's saying that that's not what he is. So she's saying, I disagree with him, but that's called a disagreement. That isn't a misrepresentation. Someone, I think I got a few comments like this. Did Gavin contact Megan before his accusations? But people were also saying, did Megan contact Gavin before she went and wrote about him in the book? And I think the answer to this is, why would she? Why would she? Like, you should be able to write an article or a book on someone's public comments. Sometimes reaching out for clarification if you don't understand something is fine. But if you understand it, and I'm assuming Gavin Ortland's YouTube channel is meant to be understood, there's no reason for it. We don't expect this level of communication with other things. We don't apply this to every area of our life. We would be, and then you'd probably be in the, you know, in the problem of getting a clarification of the clarification. Did you reach out to clarify his clarification of his clarification? Like at some point you just got to say, this is what he said, this is why I disagree. So I don't have any problem with her doing this. I really don't have a problem with Gavin not reaching out to Megan, except for he seems upset that she didn't reach out to him, or he thinks that's like a mark against her. So yeah, like if you're going to say that, you should reach out to her. Like if you're going to apply that standard, just apply it to yourself. Let's continue here. Ortland takes it on faith that extreme local weather events are increasing, even though when you compare actual data with models, you get different answers. She goes through some of that. The hurricane season of 2022 saw the weakest storm levels in 42 years. The number of hurricanes hasn't been a particular uptick. We conclude that the historical Atlantic hurricane data at this stage does not provide compelling evidence for a substantial greenhouse warming induced century scale increase. anyway, she just gives you some facts, some raw numbers, or links to where you can find the raw numbers if you want to find them. Claims regarding prolonged record heat has also required reading the fine print to discover that the most severe heat waves in U.S. history were in the 1930s. Ortlund cites only one scientific authority in his video, the same one that the ECI cited 16 years earlier in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which he describes as a group of leading scientists from all over the world. He goes on to say that every scientific body of national or international standing agrees that human-caused global warming is a serious problem. So to not accept this consensus, he says, is to buy into a, quote, conspiracy and hoax. It is a failure to, quote, take a responsible posture, unquote, as a Christian. The reason Gavin wants to challenge us, or what he uses to challenge us again, is that quote at the end where he's like, hey, study it and make your own, come to your own ideas about these things, you know, as long as you study it. But it's like he had a 15-minute video. He said a lot of things in there. And Megan acknowledges on the previous page that, yeah, he says he's not being a doomsdayer, but look, it seems like he is being. So she's saying there is a... there's tension in what Wortland's saying. Some of the things he says seem to contradict other things he says. She's acknowledging this. And this is, I think, something I see in Big Eva. I know I've gone over this many times before, talking about issues in evangelicalism, where someone, Russell Moore, I think, does this, where he will have an article that's kind of a word salad. Al Mohler actually is a better example of someone, in my opinion, just my opinion. Al Mohler does a lot of word salads, and you can find him almost arguing both sides of a number of issues, or he can say things that are, that both sides can somewhat appeal to on some issues. And you, like, the same sex attraction issue was like that with Al Mohler for a while, where he would say, he would have the things he would say to cover his base, where he'd be like, yeah, marriage is between one man and one woman. You know, there's only two genders, but then he would say things like, but there is this same-sex attraction category, and it's not necessarily a sin. It is a real legitimate orientation. And he would do this, and you would find things that, again, there's tension. How do you hold these views together? And I see this a lot in Big Eva. And I think that's what Megan's getting at here, too. She's saying Ortlund went on this 50-minute podcast, and he says things that are in tension with one another. And Ortlund wants to point out the things that would seem to indicate that he's not, you can't color him with a broad brush. And Megan does that. Well, Megan's taking your quotes. She's making sense of them. She's forming a coherent position because she's assuming that you're trying to be coherent and your people who are listening to you are trying to be coherent. And then, yeah, you do make these other statements here and there, you know, come to your own conclusion, do your own research. But clearly the rest of the video, you're saying it's this one way. It's the consensus. And if you don't agree, then you're not somehow fulfilling your Christian responsibility. You're inadequate in some way. And this is going to lead to all kinds of bad, bad things. So anyway, Ortlund takes it on faith that extreme local weather events are increasing. So we went through that paragraph. Then Ortlund cites only one scientific authority. We talked about that. Let's go on. Why Ortlund feels his brothers and sisters must accept the prevailing climate change narrative, he offers nothing more than three magic words: love your neighbor. Yeah, it's worth pointing out that research is beginning to show that this kind of rhetoric has been fairly detrimental to our neighbors, driving an epidemic of fear and despair among young people, giving rise to new term eco-anxiety. And she talks about the devastating effects of that. I'm not going to go into all that. She starts talking about Jonathan Moo as well. He and Ortlund could consider what words of calm assurance rooted in a loving God and his stable creation would mean to generations who are deeply worried about climate change. Also, Ortlund doesn't seem to have done the full breadth of study on the issue. So she talks about Dr. Roy Spencer, a NASA climate scientist, and Cornwall Alliance, and that this scientist pointed out that a 97% consensus in the scientific community is a myth. So she just says that he hasn't done his homework. That's the accusation she makes. That's a disagreement. Again, that's not a misrepresentation. That is a disagreement. Ortlund's appeal to consensus fails to consider that several professional and reputational damage any scientist who questions the conventional wisdom risks. And in September 2023, climatologist Dr. Patrick Brown admitted in the Free Press that in order to get his paper published in Nature magazine, he deliberately left out other factors that contributed to increased wildfires in California and focused on climate change, because there's an incentive, guys. We all know this. Ortlund both began and ended his presentation by stressing that Christians should discuss the issue respectfully and not attack one another. But however softly his words were uttered, it's hard to square that, again, look, it's hard to square that with his insistence that those who hold views that differ from his can be doing so only because they are motivated by politics or haven't hit the books. This is what Megan's doing. Again, what I just pointed out, there's a tension in what Gavin Ortlund's saying. That's all it is. Gavin Ortlund wants to focus on these little things he says that seem to not fit the narrative Megan's putting down. Megan acknowledges those things and says, yeah, they don't fit the narrative that you're putting down, Gavin. There's a problem here. When I asked Beisner about Ortlund's assertion that Christians resist engaging on climate change because they've been politicized, he minced a few words. The Christians who have been activists regarding that issue are almost invariably doing so because they've been politicized. I can almost guarantee you that Gavin Ortlund has never read any significant part of the scientific reports. And this is one thing that Gavin was upset about, too, is like, hey, I've read the IPCC. I've read this stuff. She's quoting Calvin Beisner's opinion about it. She's not coming out and saying, I know for a fact Gavin Ortlund hasn't. It just seems like he wouldn't make the statements he's making if he had. And she's quoting Cal Beisner making that point. Beisner noted that, let's get out of here. Let's go back to Ortlund. Okay. So that's pretty much it on Ortlund. Okay. Here's another one. Is Ortlund aware of these scandals? This is not to single out Ortlund, who is certainly not the only young pastor promoting climate change activism, nor the only one citing the IPCC as an authority, but he is well positioned at the Keller Center. And that's pretty much it. So in the end, she summarizes this is the last paragraph of this chapter. These are complex topics. It is not wrong for pastors and Christian leaders to weigh them and debate them, but it is wrong for them to make agreement on environmental policies a test of biblical faithfulness. It is wrong to make climate change activism a measure of one's commitment to the gospel, and it is wrong to bind consciences with a blithe and unthinking love your neighbor. Now, this is one of the things that he wants to take and say that she's saying this about me. She's saying this about everyone she wrote about in the chapter. Jonathan Moo specifically did make it a test of gospel faithfulness. Like he conflated the two. I did a podcast on it. With Gavin Ortlund, it doesn't mean that applies to Gavin Ortlund directly, but Gavin Ortlund did try to make this about loving your neighbor. This is why we should care about this, why we should get involved. We should know about this. This is important. This threatens us. And this is part of our Christian duty somehow in loving our neighbor, to concern ourselves with this. So maybe a better way to, I'm trying to think, like if you're going to talk specifically about Gavin Ortlund, maybe it's not as strong as saying a test of biblical faithfulness, although I could see a way you could see it that way. But you could have also say it maybe like when it comes to specifically Gavin Ortlund, a test of a Christian's commitment to loving your neighbor or something like that. You know, your concern about this environmental issue. I don't see a huge, huge difference in those things. But again, she's not specifically naming Gavin Ortlund. This is a summary about the chapter. And yeah, I mean, this chapter, like I said, I wouldn't have led with this chapter, but you know, I still think it's a helpful chapter. And she says some things that are important for evangelicals to know that are happening with their institutions. So that I wasn't planning on doing that. I do have more objections I want to get to, but let me get to some comments now. Why doesn't anyone seem to care that Ortlund lied about the science being consensus? Well, you know, Ortlund's under the, it wasn't intentional, right? He just believes what he's read. So there you go. But yeah, people should be, I think, concerned about that. I'm looking for question marks, guys. There's a lot of comments, but specifically questions, because I can't get to every single comment. Okay, last one from Colonel JD. I don't think I'm going to show more of your stuff, Colonel. No offense, but I don't know if you're hitting the mark here. All right. Colonel JD says, again, John, nobody in your audience is disagreeing that Ortland is off base on climate change. You're missing the point of the outrage. Lying is never okay, and defending it is even worse. Okay, well, like I've said a million times, point to me the lie to me. Show me where the lie is. That's the thing that I keep hearing repeated over and over. This is what I saw. They did the same thing with Russell Fuller in 2020. They've done the same thing against me. They've done the same thing against AD Robles. They've done the same thing against Protestia. It's just, you just keep saying it's a lie, it's a lie, it's a lie. And we want to ask for specifics. Where's the lie? Show me where the lie is. And then you don't really get anything that you can sink your teeth into. And that's a problem. That's actually, I think, there should be public backlash for that kind of thing, because you are actually harming someone's character. You may say, oh, you're harming someone's character. Yeah, okay. By trying to tell the truth about them. Now, if I messed up, or if Megan messed up, or if someone else messed up and we lied, point it out. Give us the opportunity to correct it if we did something wrong. That would be, I think, the Christian approach to this. Just saying it's a lie because you don't like it, or it's a disagreement that you're now pigeonholing into, trying to make it sound like it's a lie. No, that's not the same thing. All right. I don't know if someone's trying to tell me a specific here. Tom Carpenter, give me something more substantial. I don't know if you're trying to give me a specific or not. I'm not sure if this is to not accept that consensus, he says. And then she says he followed that through with is to buy into a conspiracy and hoax. And that is a failure to take a responsible posture. I'm not sure if I'm understanding the objection. I think the objection is Gavin Ortland talked about this in the video, that Megan's putting words in his mouth. She's summarizing what he's saying. You got to be more specific with me, though. You got to show me the receipts. All right, we're going to move on. If you have some actual receipts, I am more than happy to look at them. But I can't go through comments that don't have the receipts on them. All right. Next, we're going to go to this one. This is an objection. This is from a blog, this is from the Dispatch. Yeah, it's a blog. I'll say it's a blog. What shepherds are for sale, or which shepherds are for sale? And this is by a guy by the name of Warren Cole Smith. Here's just a few quotes from that particular review. Basham is right that many shepherds are in fact for sale, but the unintended irony and fundamental flaw of her book is that the corrupting money is not on the evangelical left, as she claims, but on the populist right. The rise of such organizations as Turning Point USA and its subsidiary, Turning Point Faith, the Epoch Times and the Daily Wire itself, organizations that combined bring in hundreds of millions of dollars in annual revenue, bear witness to the financial benefits of pandering to populists. Okay, so the left often likes to accuse people in the right of whataboutism. This would be your classic example, in my opinion. And in the article opens with this. That, hey, you're saying that evangelicals are bought and paid for by the left, but guess what? The right also does it. Okay, well, you're not disputing anything Megan said. That both could be true. That could be a possibility. But I would say this, there is a big difference here. Even if both are true, there is a big difference. The idea with the money that Megan's tracing on the left is that it's somewhat hidden. Now she's able to find it and stuff, but it's not, like Turning Point Faith, for example, is obvious. You go to a Turning Point rally and there's some pastors there that were invited to speak there. Pretty obvious stuff, right? You get money from Pierre Odemar, you know, for some kind of left leaning cause. That's a little different. You know, you're not being invited to the left-wing conference. These are right-leaning organizations, politically right-leaning organizations that are including pastors or Christians, leaders, in their commentary, in their part of their efforts. That's what's happening here. So I think it's different from that angle, There's another difference also that I would note is that I think that these organizations are much closer to representing a what would be in line with traditional Christian and biblical understanding and thinking. Christianity is inherently right wing. And so so that would be obvious to me. But you know, this is supposed to be one of the glaring errors, one of the problems with Megan's book. We also have, if Basham is right, then the evangelical movement is sick. She has misdiagnosed the true cause of the illness, departing from the gospel to pursue ideology and political activism. So so Basham, I guess, Megan Basham has a problem because when she looks at the evangelical landscape, she sees the wrong thing. The problem is that they're selling themselves out to, I would presume, Trump, into right-wing causes and those kinds of things. And they're departing from the gospel in sort of a left-wing critique in doing this. And she's seeing this more as a corruption of Christian discipleship and the gospel from the left. This is just a disagreement. This is a right-left disagreement. So there's really nothing you can sink your teeth into here. This isn't like an error in Megan's book. This isn't a weakness in Megan's book. This is just that the dispatch is on the left and Megan's on the right. That's all this is. None of the people I spoke with who are mentioned in the book, nearly a dozen for this article, have been contacted either by Basham or by fact checkers from HarperCollins. So her publisher didn't contact these people. You can't verify this for one thing, because he doesn't mention the dozen people. He doesn't give names. So you don't know who he's talking about. So it's hard to verify. But again, I pointed this out before. If someone's making a public statement, if it's on the record, there's no reason for you to do that. If there's something that you need clarification on, if there's something that was privately said and you need to find out where it was said, like those are things that you need. But for something like this, you don't. And she is a journalist, but this is also a popular level book written by a journalist, but I don't even know if Megan would call it a work of pure journalism. Like, Megan inserts her opinion in here too. So I don't know. To me, this is just pretty weak. If these are the best, you didn't contact people, you know. I wonder if he contacted Megan. Shepherds for Sale has many villains, but it only has one hero, Donald Trump. He is mentioned more than 30 times in the book, all positively or defensively. And this one to me was the most ridiculous, because I was like, I've read the book. I don't remember feeling like this was a Trump apologetic at all. And it's not. Trump is mentioned in conjunction with like evangelicals, like losing their minds and Trump derangement syndrome type stuff. They're just like going after Trump, and they see Trump as such a big deal, which the Dispatch, true to their brand, they're very against Trump too. So Trump's not the only hero. I mean, we just talked about Cal Beisner, right? Oz Guinness is mentioned favorably in the book, as I remember. I think she quotes C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, and there's all kinds of people, John MacArthur. So yeah, I don't buy that. All right. Why did I put this screenshot there? Oh, I think, again, this was just like she didn't follow journalistic standards in writing this book. Like, she doesn't have to, she's not doing a reporting piece. This isn't a report for a supposedly unbiased news organization. This is a book that Megan also has inserted her opinion in. She doesn't have to follow whatever those quote unquote journalistic rules. And I would say this too, if you're just in the academic process, like the books I've written on this just doing research and stuff, there's no requirement that you have to contact everyone that you're researching. Now, I do a lot of historical research. You can't contact them. Most of them are gone. So you have to rely on accounts that are in the public record or private letters if you go to an archive. But even if it's something that happens in the present day, even this video, right, in the podcast you listen to, we're not contacting every single person that we comment on. That would be impossible. All right. Let's see. Megan responds to this somewhat, this hit piece, if you want to call it that. Another falsehood. He claims, I did not deal with abortion rates going up under Trump. Here is where I do. Says one of the claims was made that she didn't acknowledge abortion rates going up in the Trump administration, but she did in the book. So they had to write a retraction. The dispatch ends up being sloppy. Of the many distortions and outright falsehoods in the Dispatch piece, here are two. Warren says he received no response to his request to interview me, blatantly false, as demonstrated here by some of our text exchanges. That last crop bubble is me giving him my email address. So I did look at this, and yes, there's a conversation between them, and Megan does give him her email address. And then, you know, he's claiming that he received no response. And it's like, Megan's like, what are you talking about? So earlier when I said, did he reach out to Megan? The answer was yes, but he didn't follow up. So they didn't, he even says he'd like to have her on his podcast and ghosted, I guess. So there you go. All right. So is this the last? Yeah, this is the last one. This was today. There was a whole Twitter thread. And I was like, they're all kind of the same in my mind, these objections. And so let me explain to you what's happening here. And then I will try to see if there was any receipts anyone wanted me to talk about in the live chat here. All right. Neil Shenvey, who goes to J.D. Greer's church. He's how would I describe Neil for those who don't know him? If you're not on X, you might not know who he is. He is, I guess he's a homeschool dad who he's written for. He has written, I think, a few times for the Gospel Coalition, if I'm not mistaken. His thing is kind of like critiquing wokeness, but now also the dissident right from, I would say, a more liberal perspective, like a classic liberal. I don't even know if it's just classic liberal, though. It's kind of like a liberal neutral perspective. And he goes to J.D. Greer's church. So I think this is somewhat defensive of Greer, but this is an example of the kind of thing that he was doing this afternoon. So this is a little quote. This is like two lines from Megan's book where she says, Greer went on to liken those leaving churches over woke teaching to a synagogue of Satan. So then he puts a quote from Greer. And I remember doing a whole podcast on this particular episode or on this particular speech of J.D. Greer's. So I remember coming to the exact same conclusion Megan did. But Neil wants, I think he wants to point out that there's tension between these things. So here's the quote from J.D. Greer. You ready? Here's J.D. Greer. A lot of church people left their churches, not just Summit Church, but a lot of them, because of some disagreement over relatively small political disagreement, at least small in light of the gospel and in light of eternity. Well, you didn't say enough about this particular cultural issue, so I'm leaving. You said too much, so I'm leaving. And I would say to these people, some of you have been in our churches for years, for a decade. And I would say we agree on every point of gospel doctrine. We believe in the gospel. We believe in the authority and inerrancy of the Bible. We believe in the sanctity of life and marriage. I married your children. I walked with you through the tragedy of death of a loved one. And now you are leaving because you disagreed because we said too much, too many things about George Floyd, or we said not enough about him, or because we asked you to wear a mask or for a season, or because we did not keep the mask mandate in place long enough. We Christians say that we hate cancel culture, but it was amazing to me how many of us canceled our church over a relatively small disagreement. And I kind of look at that and I say, no wonder, because we pastors get to disciple our people 1 hour a week, and Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and Rachel Maddow get them for 3 hours a night. You know, when the church gets in bed with politics, the church gets pregnant, and the offspring does not look like our Heavenly Father. It looks like a synagogue of Satan. I'm not saying they're necessarily from Satan or that they are not a Christian, just that conflating allegiance to Jesus Christ with allegiance to secondary world powers is a tactic or an enemy. So here would be the tension, right? Greer went on to liken those leaving churches over woke teaching to a synagogue of Satan. Well, in the quote that you just saw supplied there, it seems like what Greer's saying is this could be people who leave over it's not woke enough, in addition to its being woke. And I'll grant you, given the words that Neil provided there, it would seem that way if you separated it from the context. And the context of Greer's remarks are from a church that the overwhelming majority of people who left were leaving because Greer was too woke. On political issues, it was because Greer was too woke. I did several episodes on this whole issue. I remember having to explain cancel culture because of the way Greer frames it in this. Cancel culture is trying to make someone an outcast from society, unemployable. That kind of thing. It's ruining them. That's cancel culture. Someone leaving a church isn't cancel culture. They're not canceling you because they choose not to go to your church anymore. Greer also made statements at the Southern Baptist Convention where it is purely, it is I should say overwhelmingly slanted left, going after terrorists and Pharisees and neo-Confederates and, you know, these horrible people in churches that are, they're making an idol out of politics is what's happening. Well, Greer's the one pushing the needle left. That's the whole context of this. And now he's complaining that people are leaving his church. So in that context, what Megan says is perfectly accurate, and it would be accurate anyway. If Megan said people who, let's say, disagreed over politics, Greer called, and left over political disagreements, Greer called the synagogue of Satan. That could also be accurate. But in the context of Greer's church, it's because he went too far woke. And to quote Trump, you know it, I know it, everyone knows it. So this is the kind of thing I see. And there's a bunch of examples Neil gave that were like this, where he's trying to make a tension between Megan's source and then Megan's summary quote about something. And sometimes the quotes are in contexts that give you more information about what is actually being communicated in those contexts. I think that there's nothing wrong with summarizing what someone said and what they meant and in the context they meant it in. This is part of the process of just doing basic research and trying to understand someone. If you approach someone with the intention of, I want to understand where they're coming from, what they're reacting to. And in that particular speech, I believe that one was at Southeastern, if I'm not mistaken, which gives you another clue about context. Place also matters. Greer is upset. Like, he gets upset in that particular speech. Like, he's not calm. He's angry about people who have left Summit Church. And I happen to know, I lived there for a while, and I know a bunch of the people who did leave. And that is exactly what was happening. It was over woke stuff and COVID craziness and all that kind of stuff. All right. Let's get to some comments. I want to react, or, you know, and maybe some of you have some legitimate things. If you have critiques or if you have questions or whatever, let's get to those. I'm looking for question marks. Again, that's how I will see your comment. Discernment equals cancel culture. Yeah. It seems that way, doesn't it? We all just listened to Gavin in his own words. What are these Gavin defenders even talking about? I don't know, to be quite honest with you. It's the weirdest thing to me. It's just like circle the wagons, I guess. Let's see. I'm having a hard time Tom Carpenter, if you could like just succinctly give me something. He says, Protestia splice material. Their splice material ends up saying something the source neither said nor meant. It is sad, and that's extremely common in journalism now. How so, though? Again, I need like reasons here. How is what I'm assuming that's the video I played of Gavin. I normally do those kinds of things myself when I have the time to do them. But if you want to go listen to all 50 minutes, listen to all 50 minutes. I don't have time for a podcast. We've been going an hour and 20. We can't go 3 hours on a podcast to say the same thing. So it's perfectly fine. I'm going to get blue in the face, I guess, saying this. It is perfectly fine in the journalistic or the research process, the research and academic process, scholarly process. It is perfectly fine to summarize what someone said or meant. Now, you can do it inaccurately and you can be called on the carpet for it, but you should be able to do it accurately. That's the whole point. To save people time so that they can interact with the idea, so they can get at the nugget of truth that's in there or the nugget that they need to interact with and get past all the fluff. That's the point. That's just scholarship. It is taking quotes and it is building arguments. There seems to be a group of people out there that don't think, or that think that you have to supply every single thing a person said or else you're not quoting them right. It involves not just the quotes, it involves the context in which they happened historically, who is saying it, what they're reacting to, what their audience is, what do they want to communicate? That's authorial intent. Like all the things that you would use in studying the Bible, okay? This is mostly a Christian audience. You also use when you're out there studying the world around you. It's the same stuff. You know, pastors that preach sermons on topics and they take verses from here and verses from there. Yeah, you got to be careful with that, but you should be able to do it in a responsible fashion. And I think that Megan did a pretty good job doing that. At least I haven't seen any really good arguments against it. Do you plan to listen to Chris Date's defense of Gavin later? I don't know who Chris Date is. Probably not. I've already said so much more about Gavin than I ever intended. John, I commented about the standard journalistic technique of summing a subject idea. This is from Protestia, summing a subject's ideas with multiple quotes. Yeah, thank you. And I think that's probably David Morrill. Thank you, David. That's what Tom was responding to. Okay. I guess great minds think alike. Did he say 50 million years? Yes, he did. Gavin Ortland did say 50 million years. John, will you support your sister-in-law in her presidential run? Kamala Harris. My father assures me that Kamala Harris is from a different line. We are the Scottish Harrises, and she is part of the English Harris line. And he also assures me, I actually saw an article that talked about this, that her relatives, now this was from the Irish Times, though, and said she was Irish. So, okay. But that her ancestors owned slaves. The Harrises on her side owned slaves. My Harrises did not. So, I don't know. I think if we're going to do a reparations bill, Kamala needs to pay. But yeah, I'm. It's embarrassing. I want to distance myself, but it is my last name. I'm going to have to run for president to try to take this, you know, stand up for my good name. Sean says, am I the only one having a hard time seeing where she misquoted or misrepresented him? No, you're not. This has been the issue for the whole time. Was she building a straw man by using Ortland and maybe not accurately even in the context? No, she wasn't building a straw man. She was accurate. She was summing him up. She can summarize. Different Harrises. Yes, very, very much. Let's see here. What would Elvis do? Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't even know what that has to do with. I don't know what that even, where that came from. Summarizing may include quoting, but it is not quoting. Yeah, did anyone? Of course. No one's disputing this. John, when someone uses the Bible to build a belief system, would that be considered derivative theology? I like that term since it helps me understand where things can go off the rails. You know, I don't know if I've heard the term derivative theology. I think it's just called theology. If, you know, things that the Bible teaches and then assumptions it makes, assumptions that the things that the Bible assumes and then principles that the Bible advocates that you build a belief system off of in some way, or that you, that you through logic and reason can come to a conclusion and an application on a certain issue. We usually say that's by good and necessary consequence. So the Bible teaches marriage is between a man and a woman. And by good and necessary consequence, that also precludes a man from being part of, you know, two men from being part of that arrangement. So yeah, of course, if you want to call that derivative theology, sure. All right. Well, those are all the questions. And last chance before I end the podcast, because we're almost an hour and a half in. And I was only going to go an hour, but we needed to read Megan's book. I hope that was helpful for all of you out there. Isn't that just called systematic theology? Yeah, pretty much. Came in late. Are we discussing the recent interview with author of Shepherds for Sale? Yep, we're done. We're done with that. Disagree with Megan if you want, but it is disgusting at Ortland's fanboy spamming YouTube pages with comments. You know, I don't know a lot about this, and I don't want to make an accusation because I don't know a lot about it, but I have seen this accusation floating around. And it might not be Ortland who is sending them to do this. It may just be people who are defensive of Ortland doing this. But I have seen some reviews on Amazon of people who clearly haven't read the book, and they're there to defend Ortland. So the Shen V back and forth is still going on. Even Basham is getting done with it now, and she's pretty magnanimous. Yep. Between Gavin Ortland and Gavin Newsom, I think I will never name my son Gavin. Yeah. Don't name him Gavin. And if you have the last name Moore, then you got to redeem that name as well. I was just thinking that Harris needs to be redeemed. Moore needs to be redeemed. Wolf seems like a pretty good last name to have. Send more pics of the baby. My wife talked to me about this, and she said, there's got to come a point where you stop posting pictures of the baby. And I said, yeah, you're right. But we got to be somewhat protective. So I don't know. I don't know how much longer that'll be. I'll try. I'll see if I can convince her. All right. Well, that is it for today. Hey, if you have, you know, the live stream's over and you have questions, cries of outrage, conundrums, or if you just think that I was off in an area, I'm always willing to listen. Put a comment on the video and I will see if I can get to it. God bless. I hope you have a wonderful evening. More come in later this week. And one last note to patrons. If you are a patron, if you support the work I do, Worldview, I'm trying to remember my website. JohnHarrisPodcast.com is the website, but for Patreon, it's patreon.com/worldviewconversation to support the podcast. I was supposed to, at the end of last week, have a follow-up. I did a video on slavery and apologetics, and that got some really good responses from the patrons, and there's a follow-up video. It's going to have to be this week. So that is coming, and God bless. So, yeah. Questions are coming in that I've already answered. Did you see Gavin's response? I listened to both of them and already commented on it. All right. God bless. I got to go now. Bye now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.